Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hi, this is Mary Robson bringing you this week's Nature Now as spring creeps slowly toward us. And about our guest, do you remember the movie Up, where their slogan is, "Adventure is out there"? It's a great movie. Today, we are going to meet Bob Jepperson. He has been finding adventure close to his home nearly every day for 10 years, walking, photographing, recording sounds, and writing. His searching on Fidalgo Island resulted in a newly published book, Wild Love Story. We'll follow Bob's path. And for today's mystery sound. The interesting thing is, this is Bob's recording, and during his talk, he'll explain the mystery sound. That's a change, but keep listening. For observations, Charlie Fleshman is going to help with today's observations. My first one is about frozen ground. You probably realized when you stepped on the ground that it crunched, and the soil temperature out near Cape George has been hovering around 38 degrees. It was today, no longer frozen hard as it was in February. It is too cold for much plant emergence. The shady north sides of paths stay cold and freeze again quickly. Where light strikes, the growth of wild plants will leap in the next weeks. The native red currant is already growing, but slowly. The leaves I've seen on it are still smaller than a dime size. And by the way, a soil thermometer fits nicely into a backpack and helps investigations when hiking. It's without obviously disturbing the soil.
On bird action, happily, varied thrushes eat a non-native plant named Catani aster, and they've been gobbling for the last few days. Most birds don't choose this plant's berries. They are dry-looking red blobs, and the thrushes have no competition for them, at least not this week.
And torpor in hummingbirds. We have mentioned this before, but it occurred to me during the snow and ice storms. These are sturdy birds. That's the best word for anise hummingbirds. They'll fly into a snowstorm to reach the backyard feeders. They start looking for food about a half an hour before sunrise. In my garden, the males arrive at the fence and scold if I am late in hanging the feeders. But what keeps the anise hummingbird from freezing at night? They are protected from freezing by being able to drop their body temperatures at night. They do not have special feathers that act as down. They do not use birdhouses or holes in trees. They overnight on branches hanging down. Many of us know this state as torpor. The temperature drops, the metabolism slows dramatically, the heart rate slows. This is not sleep. Observers have said it's possible to touch a bird in torpor without making it move.
Other birds can go into torpor. Hummingbirds are not the only birds capable of protecting themselves from cold by torpor. Chickadees, swifts, and doves do it. Probably other birds do also, and have not yet been studied. The hummingbird comes out of torpor by shivering and exists on its last food eaten before dark. The normal daytime temperature of a hummingbird is 104 degrees Fahrenheit, the same as a domestic cat. The cats covered with fur seek warm radiators, while the anise hummingbirds fly for food. Information on torpor is from Billy Frank of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Bird work. Spring is approaching for nuthatches. An observer sent photos taken at Union Bay in Seattle last week showing a nuthatch making a nest hole in a tree trunk. The female nuthatch excavates a bit of wood at a time, a piece about the size of a small breadcrumb, really small. Over and over, and trading work with the male, they work bit by small bit until a proper hole exists. That's from the UW Tweeters blog. We'll be talking with Bob Jepperson now. Hi, Bob. Thanks for coming to share your deep world as winter changes to spring. First, give us an idea of where you go and how your forest visits have evolved over the years.
I live on Fidalgo Island, just south of Anacortes. But wherever I've lived during my adult life, I managed to find a wild place nearby because I like to visit often and get to know a place well. So this past 10 years, my wild place has been the forest and beaver ponds here on Fidalgo Island. And I visit them every day, sometimes twice during what I call the high drama seasons. And we're in one of those seasons right now, and hopefully we'll have time to get to that later.
Certainly the fact that all the birds are waking up, it's going to be mating season before we know it, and that does lead to high drama, doesn't it?
Well, it does. We're kind of past mating season for some, the ones that I've been focusing on, but we'll save that.
Okay, we'll save it.
What I do has changed over the years, though. When I discovered our trails in the local forest here, I began by exploring. Then that turned to an interest in the kind of natural dramas that I was finding. So it's a bit like finding a good book, like finding a page-turner, we call them. And I'm to the point now where I don't want to miss a page, and that's why I go every day, because there are dramas going on year-round. Over the years, my reading speed has slowed, and I cover less ground now. And it seems like the slower I go, the more I see.
I think that's a very common experience with people. Think of Thoreau, who went slower and slower around his world. I didn't ask you this before. Is there any threat to this forest? Is it likely to be developed, or is it protected in some way?
It's in public hands with conservation easements. It's actually quite large.
Okay.
2,800 plus acres, we're lucky. With a good system of trails, so we have access to a lot of it. Over the years here, I've begun to take pictures, and the last 6 years record sound, and then at the root of it all is my writing. Writing is my outlet when I come home after witnessing
something. Let's think about outlets in the terms of beaver ponds. How do they look now? And I have to ask you, do beavers hibernate?
Well, our beavers don't hibernate. The beavers in this area were trapped out. And when they were trapped out, the dams fell into repair and the ponds drained. But now we have beavers back because nobody's out there trapping. They've got dams, the dams back up water, and then they live in lodges that are separate from the dam. They can be a long ways from their dams.
Ah.
And they go into their lodge, which looks like a big mound of mud and sticks, through an underwater entrance, and they're in there safe and away from the elements. And when the pond freezes over, they'll stay in their lodge, but they've got an underwater stash of food, sticks that are stuck into the mud, and they can eat the bark off those in a pinch.
Okay, so it's kind of the squirrel effect. They're taking care of themselves for winter.
Yeah, they set aside some food for winter. Here's what's going on in the ponds right now, Mary.
Okay, bring us right up to the moment.
Okay. I see pond lilies out there. One of our ponds, my favorite one, happens to be just the right depth for pond lilies. And right now, the first leaves are poking through the water. In fact, some of the very earliest leaves got frozen in ice. They won't die, but they'll have brown tips this year. And you can imagine a beaver pond that's over 20 acres in size, completely open with nothing on the water in the wintertime. But from now through spring, enough pond lilies will come up to cover it, completely cover it. And I know when we think about pond lilies, we picture leaves lying flat on the water, but most of them don't do that. Most of the stalks continue to grow, and the leaves are, 18 inches, maybe 2 feet above the water, waving in the breeze like flags. And in that cover, a lot of wildlife benefits. For example, we have, throughout the year on one beaver pond, we have 5 species of ducks.
Ah.
And of those 5, 3 of them breed there, the hooded mergansers, the mallards, and the wood ducks. And imagine in the summertime, one wood duck hen with 10 ducklings in tow meandering through the protective cover of a forest of tall pond lilies. They love that shelter, and they choose that pond for that very reason.
Since these ponds are very central to what you see, we might want to switch from birds to amphibians. I have a fascination with frogs. And do you find frogs regularly? Are you hearing them yet? Which frogs do you see? The whole nine yards about frogs.
Okay. We have two common species of frogs at our ponds here. One of them is small and has a big voice. That's the chorus frog. Some people call them tree frogs, the Pacific chorus frog. And what they should be doing right now, if we were having normal weather, is migrating to the edges of ponds and chorusing.
Mm-hmm.
They're loud. Collectively, they make so much noise, I can hear them a half a mile away. Usually
wow.
That happens in late February to early March is when they usually start chorusing. But where I live, they haven't started yet just because it's so cold outside.
I have heard them only intermittently here also. So I think it's
okay.
We just are having a slightly delayed spring in that way.
Sure. They're so loud that I have to quit recording owl sounds once they start up.
Okay. This is the segue into the red-legged frog. And for all of you listening, our mystery sound is the red-legged frog. And that recording was done by Bob. And he promises us that he will tell us some more about it. So if you're waiting for the mystery sound to be identified, this is it. Here we go.
The red-legged frog is our other common frog, and instead of being the small frog with the big voice, it's the larger frog with the small voice. And most people, unless they see one, are not even aware of their presence. Most people will walk right by a vocalizing red-legged frog and not even notice it. They have a really tiny voice. And those of you who have listened to the mystery recording, maybe you thought, wow, that sounds like a little duck. They do. They sound like a miniature quacking duck. I begin my book with a story of what happens in January, usually, when red-legged frogs come out of hiding. And
would you read a little bit of that from your book?
I can do that. Let me just read two paragraphs. I had not heard a red-legged frog in many weeks. Their subtle vocals can be elusive, but I've learned this. Once we hear the sounds made by a species, especially those that make subtle sounds, we're more likely to hear them again. Something happens in our minds. We tune into what we recognize, and the rare seems to become more common. I hike toward a waterway where a beaver dam separates two ponds, and I'm just 50 feet from the water's edge when I hear resonant voices, something akin to the sound of human conversation at a distance. The closer I approach, the more I realize I'm hearing the voices of a frog species that utters unfrog-like sounds. Imagine the quacking of a miniature muzzled duck, and you come close to imagining the totally underwhelming sound produced by a northern red-legged frog.
So that's a piece of your book, A Wild Love Story. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering just one more thing about the red-leggeds. I have only seen one once. It was in a garden where I was working, and it was in the middle of the summer, and I thought it might be lost. After they've mated, where do they go? Do they stay around the pond, or...
Well, they do. Now, this is an exceptional year, and it's affected them, too. On February 2nd, when the temperature reached 48 degrees this year, they came out of their forest hiding spots where they spend most of the year, and we saw them all over the place, on the trails and in the water. We saw frogs grabbing other frogs. I call them little rodeos, and they're splashing and thrashing. And then the large females, when they show up, males are attracted to them, and they cling to them in what some people call frog piles. That's what the recording is from. I held my big 22-inch parabola over a frog pile, and you can hear the males and the females.
But this year they are delayed, yes?
They are delayed. They came out February 2nd, and they started doing their thing, and then it got cold again, and now I'm not seeing them in the water at all. I'm expecting them to come back out, though, because they spend the summer season lolling, floating on water. sometimes just their eyes poke up above the water and they'll be in the duckweed waiting for something to come along and eat. And then when fall comes and winter, they'll go back in the forest and hide under logs.
They basically hide under duff and leaves and pine needles and all the things they can find, yes?
They do, yeah.
And for those of you who are wondering about listening to frogs and other things, Bob's book has interior applications that you can click on and access the sounds he has recorded for the photos on the page. This is so modern. I absolutely love it.
I actually use the primitive method. My wife uses those little QR codes with her smartphone. But you can get there the old-fashioned way and just enter my website, which maybe you'll provide that.
Okay. And I have a couple more questions. Your book says you are following high dramas, and I know you said you were observing one now, and this is also about knowing individuals by their voices. So could you tell us a little more about that drama?
Well, what's on my radar lately is the courtship of great horned owls. They court before barred owls, which the barred owls are other common species in the forest here. And so I'm out there until dark. I come before dark. I stay till after dark. And I'm not doing photography in the dark, but I'm recording sound. When I go over to the forest, it's about a 6-minute drive for me. I go through 7 great horned owl breeding territories just on my way in 6 minutes. They're all over the place. If I stand outside at home, I hear them calling from 2 territories. And where I go, I hear them calling from 2 more territories. So I hike in and I go right where the action is. I could read you a piece I wrote this week.
Okay.
If you'd like to hear.
Let's leap into it. It's going to just bring us to what we want to say about these owls. So go ahead.
Okay. You know, my watch reads 5:37 p.m. This was just a few days ago. And I'm smack in the heart of a great horned owl courtship venue. Usually they're hooting by now, but not this evening. I'm near a tall, ancient Douglas fir, one that's very important to these owls. It's been their nesting tree for 2 years, in fact, and what I'm seeing this week tells me they're going to use it again. 20 minutes after I arrive, I still hear no sound, but I spy an owl perched on the dead lower limb of a large tree. Against the evening sky, I make out the silhouette of a great horned owl. I can't be sure whether I'm watching a male or a female. I approach a little closer to within about 70 feet. I'd, of course, like to approach closer than that, but if the owl flies to another perch, I could lose my chance to witness what comes next. Then I hear something, deep calls from a male owl in the distance. His calls include 5 hoots. That's standard for great horned owls in this area. He calls many times, but the owl I'm watching remains silent for a few minutes, then answers in a higher-pitched voice that solves the gender mystery. I am watching a female, and her voice is like a fingerprint. It tells me that this is the owl I know as Mrs. Wiggle. No other owl sounds quite like her.
And you had said that you know at least 6 of these owls personally, right?
I do. The great horns are pretty easy to tell by their voices, so I think I know 6 now.
You mentioned the pond lilies, which that sounds amazing. That's something I have to come and see. But I know that this time of year, we have another type of plants that come up. One of them that is very hard to miss, which is called skunk cabbage. Do they have them? Obviously, they must, because it's a very, very basic plant on a pond edge this time of year. Have they started up?
Oh, yes, they've started up, but they, too, have been affected by the cold weather. I see them along the margins, and a few of them are showing off their yellow blooms right now, not nearly like they would be if we hadn't have gone back into cold weather. Other things that are happening on the pond. Well, on February 11th, we had our first midge hatch. And midges are small flies. They kind of look like mosquitoes, but they don't bite. And on February 11th, it was only 42 degrees, but it was sunny that day. And thousands of them hatched. I wouldn't call it a large hatch, but it was a pretty good hatch. And those early hatchers, they benefit because there's no predators of them yet. There's no swallows, no dragonflies, no damselflies. A lot of them must survive, and more hatches will come later, and they're an important food for many of our birds and insects.
Do ducks eat midges? Do we know?
Oh, they do.
Okay.
I would say late in the summer season, every pond lily has about 1,000 dead insects on it. It's just amazing. It's almost like fur on a mammal. And mallards and wood ducks, they go around and they pick those insect carcasses off the pond lilies.
It's a little like a buffet.
Yeah, it is. And they also sweep them from the surface of the water. Mallards tip their head forward and just kind of scoop them up like a vacuum cleaner.
I think there's probably no insect in the world, with the possible exception of the flea, that doesn't have something really good to do. And
I think so.
Your picture of midges in your book looks like a really astonishing snowstorm. Which it isn't at all. It's a very effective picture.
It's a phenomenon that it's hard to ignore when the big hatches come. And then if you walk along the margin of our beaver ponds right now, you're going to see salamander egg masses, ones that are about the size of a goose egg.
Good heavens.
Oval and covered by clear gel material. Most of those are from our northwestern salamander, which becomes an important source even for owls when they're feeding their young.
Question about that. If we have a pile of salamander eggs the size of a goose egg, is that the product of one salamander or lots of salamanders?
That's the product of one female salamander. Okay. They're actually wrapped around a twig, maybe 6 inches to 2 feet underwater. One time I stood on the shore and I could count 46 egg masses. It's like seeing an Easter egg collection out there. They vary in size from, the tennis ball size to maybe the size of a softball.
Okay, so that's one reason why all those little hatched salamanders can help feed other beings, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no kidding.
Have you seen any other types of salamanders? I know there are newts, which are not salamanders.
Oh, sure. Twice a year, the rough-skinned newts, our most toxic creature, we could talk about that sometime, they migrate from their terrestrial habitat to their aquatic habitat. So I see them in the spring and I see them in the fall, and they're very slow moving. They're ideal for photographers because when they see me, they freeze. And I can get right down nose to nose with them and take nice macro shots of them. And if I don't like their pose, I'll walk 20 feet away and they'll start moving again, and then I come back.
Yeah, and you don't want to get any closer than nose to nose because their skin is so toxic, right?
Okay. Well, you don't want to get their toxins in your eyes or nose, or if you ingest them, you're a goner.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Oh,
well, we'll add newts to the future discussion.
Okay.
Because that's fascinating.
Okay.
I wanted to include a quote from you that I find really summarizes what you've been doing. I know some wild creatures as individuals. Once we forest visitors get to that stage, wild places become personal experience. And that is certainly what you have created. So
thank you
so much. Thanks for taking us to the world of Wild Love Story. And we'll look forward to when you get back on Nature Now.
Thank you, Mary.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Events. The first events are on opportunities for students during the upcoming school break, April 2nd to 5th. I'm listing them now because it's necessary to get reservations. The first is the Jefferson Land Trust seeks high school students age 16 and up for the 2018 Spring Break Youth Corps. Applications are due by March 21st. Participants gain valuable land management experience from this field-based internship program. And the Port Townsend Marine Science Center from April 2nd to 5th, 10 to 3 daily, they are doing Spring into the Salish Sea. This is for ages 8 to 10. Register by March 26th and get a hold of the Marine Science Center for more information.
The Native Plant Society on March 9th from 10 a.m. to 12 noon at the Katai Prairie Preserve. Weeding and welcome to spring work party. Meet at the parking lot within the Port Townsend Golf Course by the Katai sign. Goals this year will be to repair the perimeter fence, weed invasive species, and enjoy the early emerging plants.
Washington Botanical Symposium, which is on March 21st, 9 to 4. The University of Washington Center for Urban Horticulture is sponsoring this. The reason I am announcing it now is they have arranged a website availability for remote attendance if you want the information but can't get there. More information on the UW Center for Urban Hort website. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic, live, and eclectic reports. Thanks to Charlie Fleischman for engineering the words and the sounds. And if you want to listen again, Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesday with repeats here at KPTZ on Thursdays at 5 p.m. and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Podcasts are also available on the website at www.kptz.org. That's us.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Find out more about Bob Jepperson, his writing, and his book at bobjepperson.com. Closing music this week, The Captain Always Goes Down with the Ship, recorded by Red Leg.